Good morning. Call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today is Thursday, correct?
Yes.
The 24th of February, 2005. It's now 8:41 a.m. Have Senator Guess online. Have Senator French with us. Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seekins. And we are going to continue on with Senate Bill 83, where we were yesterday. And you'll notice that in your packet you've got a working document. Golf.
That's the latest.
That is the latest version and incorporates the amendment that we adopted yesterday. So I entertain a motion to adopt golf as our working document.
Mr. Chair, I move that 08/golf be adopted for the sake of debate and conversation.
Is there objection? Hearing none, we're considering golf. We do not show any additional people that want to testify on the bill. At this point in time, we'll kind of leave that open. If someone comes in a little late, we'll be tolerant of that today, of people who are late.
I hope not just today, Mr. Chairman. I know I'm sometimes late myself.
We don't always hold it against people early in the morning. Now, if we find out you've already had your first cup of coffee.
This is just my first one.
If we have the department here this morning, I think we probably will have some more questions and debate. Who would like to represent the department this morning? We've got Law and Hess here this morning. And ladies, just for our record, if you'd once again put yourselves, your names on the record for us.
Stacy Crayley from the Department of Law.
Marcy Kanai from the Department of Health and Social Services.
Senator Guess, just so we know that we have our communication open, can you hear us this morning?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Senator Speaker.
Thank you very much. Okay. So we are functional, ladies and gentlemen. Any questions this morning for Stacy or Marcy? Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, I noticed the provision of national military emergency. Is that a big problem, little problem as far as military service members in the state, child custody?
Which page are you looking at, Senator?
I'm sorry, that's page number 2, section 2, paragraph 1.
Okay, we got 108 golf or 182 golf. Which one is which? I got a second row of golf, 108. Oh, I'm sorry. Got it. Yeah. Got it. I was right wrong. Okay, got it. Okay.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, we're both a little baffled by that language in terms of what we're looking to do with the Office of Children's Services, but we can look into that and get back with you. I'm not sure where that came from or how it ended up in a China bill.
Isn't it just an exemption for a PFD qualification?
It is, but I'm not sure. It is under the exemption provisions, but I'm not sure where. I mean, one we're concerned with is under Section 2, subparagraph 2.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Guess.
Yes, it looks like it's just because they put it under Section 2 under F, they just had to take it out of the F paragraph and put it under 1. It just seems like a move to keep that section in there about the national military emergency.
Okay, that probably is a good observation. Let's take a quick look.
They're just four lines above the sentence we're looking at.
Right.
Taking it out of there and putting it in its own.
Right. I think this must be construction.
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Does that answer your question, Senator?
It did.
Why don't we just take a little pause, because we do have Linda Wilson online this morning, and we told Linda that we would allow her to testify on this bill today, since we were running tight on time yesterday. And Linda, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. So if you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. This is Linda Wilson with the Public Defender Agency.
And Linda, do you have Virgin Golf?
No, I do not have Virgin Golf. I just came in on the last 5 minutes with some of the changes. If my comments are at this point not, you know, appropriate to any changes, you know, jump in and tell me.
We'll fax you to the LIO. We'll have them fax a version so that as we go along, you can have a working copy if you'd like.
Okay.
All right. We'll have our aide take care of that.
All right. I'm actually not at the LIO.
You're not? Okay. Wouldn't help us then, would it?
No.
Is there a fax number where you are?
Yeah, sure. 868-2588.
868-2588.
Yes.
Okay, it's on the way. Thank you. Go ahead.
I wanted to just give a little background about what I do. I know I testify in front of you about a lot of criminal legislation, but
did you ever send us a picture, Linda?
No, I didn't. I'll have to do that.
Okay.
We handle also cases involving child in need of aid. We represent parents in those cases. And I supervise the Anchorage unit, that because our Anchorage office is so big, we have six attorneys that specialize in representing parents in these types of proceedings. So my background was more in representing juveniles, so I come from that realm, but as supervising the family law attorneys, I've had some input on these bills that are before you today, and so I had a few comments I wanted to share. And specifically, regarding Section 1, which is the section that allows for a parent to retain sort of conditional privileges, as Ms. Crayley had mentioned in her testimony yesterday, sort of the old way of doing things, and this sort of reestablishes an old practice of where you relinquish parental rights by agreement, but you reserve your privileges of either post-adoption or visitation so that you can maintain some contact with the child if it's in the child's best interest. These are often used as a way to resolve a case that may be headed towards termination, and it's likely that that will occur, but it preserves the ability to keep contact with the biological family, especially when that is in the best interest of the child, and many times that is. So this reestablishes that old practice, which is a good thing. But I think we need to look a little further than that, because this practice is not enforceable at all. This is dealing with termination. It allows you to reserve the privilege of visitation, but if you look at that last sentence, and I think you have keyed in on that in your prior hearings, that you may not withdraw your relinquishment or have it invalidated if a retained privilege has been withheld. In other words, if you are not allowed to visit the child, even if it were in the child's best interest, you cannot withdraw your relinquishment because of that withdrawn privilege. In other words, they're not giving you the visitation you thought you were going to get. So it's not enforceable. And the reason is that the termination proceeding is happening in the China court. The adoption is a whole other proceeding. And it would be nice if in the future we could look at something post-adoption to try to make enforceable visitation rights. But the Section 1 is commendable because it puts in at least the opportunity for us to continue to use this as a tool in cases, and if we do have cooperative adoptive parents, so many times they know the biological family and they are very cooperative, it's a good thing. So support it, but wish we could do a little bit more for parents in these very difficult situations.
Linda, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Senator Seekins, in a termination, if this was not enforceable, would that be a detriment to the adopting parents? Would it cause them to think a little harder about whether or not they're going to adopt the child?
You mean if it were enforceable?
If it were enforceable, I'm sorry.
Well, that's a possibility. But again, I think because of the language in here that you're not going to be able to, it's not going to be a basis to withdraw your relinquishment. In other words, it's not going to undo the adoption. If there was perhaps just a mechanism in the adoption statutes for a parent to try to secure visitation, but many times when you relinquish, they don't notify you of any of the proceedings in the adoption case. So you don't know what's happening post-termination, especially if it's voluntary. But, there's a tension there. You know, and it is difficult in many cases to get adoptive parents. So, but then again, many times it's in the child's best interest to maintain contact with the biological family. So there aren't any easy answers.
And I know these are regrettable circumstances in the first place.
Yes.
And I know we're looking out, trying to look out for the best interests of the child. And, but at the same time, parents, it can be a terrible circumstance for a parent as well.
Yes.
But I'm just trying to think, if I were going to adopt a child, I would hope that part of the reason I was going to do that was because I was trying to look out for the best interests of the child, and that there was something there, there's a certain amount of authority that would have to go with that. I just don't want us to get to a point where we would cause prospective adoptive parents to be deterred from reaching across and bringing that child into a permanent relationship.
And that was true, and Mr. Chairman, that is certainly something that the adoption court would consider, if there was some hesitation on the adoptive parent's part to work, with the biological parents, if you had some disagreement there about that. You know, in many, many cases, though, if you have adoptive parents that know the biological family, these things work out fine.
I think if that was an option of the adoptive parents, then I don't have a problem with that, because I know, I've been in the human relations business for 35 years as a used car salesman. And I will tell you that parents, adults can twist with the minds of children, and for their own benefit, not always for the benefit of the child. And I guess if a relationship has been terminated by a court, there's a problem in the relationship. And then there's someone who says, here, come and be part of my family. Hopefully there's a strength to that relationship. There's that maybe would be stronger than the birth parent. I've known kids that were abandoned by their parents, and then they've gone on to be an adopted home, and I've seen their birth parents work on their minds, and they do it very subtly, and it's a dangerous situation in my opinion sometimes for the child, because they go through all of the abandonment syndrome. Why did my mom leave me, or why did this happen? Well, I didn't really do it, sweetheart. It was the mean bad, the big bad court that took you away from me, that kind of a thing. And I don't, there's so many different permutations of how that can come down that I can't even imagine them all. But I've seen some of them, and they're difficult situations. So how do we address this here totally in the best interest of the child? Who gets that option? Am I out of bounds here? Senator French?
I guess I'm just sort of looking at this point, this last sentence, and maybe the department can illuminate me on this, but I guess I'm looking at it just in terms of finality. You've got to have some sort of finality and inner relinquishment. If there's some provision put in there that the relinquishing parent gets to visit the child every 2 weeks, and now there's an adoption, you've got a new family, it just strikes me that it's inefficient to undo all that work if there's some dispute later on about the amount of times the relinquishing parent gets to see the child that's been moved into a new family. So I guess I see it in terms of finality, and I'm not sure what the policy was behind the sentence. Maybe the drafters can tell us.
Through the chair, Senator French, I think that's exactly the purpose of the sentence, is to have some finality in the relinquishment and in the proceedings. And as Ms. Wilson testified to, I mean, the China proceedings are separate and distinct proceedings from the adoption proceedings. And so that, I mean, I think that her point, you know, should be addressed within that context. But for purposes of what we're trying to do here is to create a mechanism by which there would be, a method by which a parent could relinquish with retained privileges, but that would be a final decision, and there would be no, 2, 3, 4 years down the road, you don't come back and have to undo a relinquishment under those circumstances. But that's exactly the purpose and the policy behind that provision.
So, Linda, if you have a concern here, what's the solution to your concern?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a... Section 1 is good the way it is. I mean, I think you have to have some finality, but it is somewhat illusory. You're allowing a parent to retain a privilege of post-adoption contact or visitation with the child, but in reality, it's not enforceable at all. So, but, you know, in many times it works out. So even though it's not enforceable, it can be a way to, I mean, if it does happen, it's a good thing. It'd be nice to maybe look ahead at some way to put in the adoption decree this retained privilege, incorporate that into the adoption decree. But, you know, then, to comment on your point about parents who manipulate or, you know, trick their children or behave inappropriately for their own gain. But, you know, that can also happen with adoptive parents.
I know.
They can be unreasonable when the biological parent is being reasonable in wanting to contact the child. So, I mean, there's examples on both sides.
I understand.
It's not an easy answer. But, you know, I think Section 1 is fine, and I think you do need some finality, but it'd be nice if we could put some enforceability into the adoption decree so that there could be visitation, if there was some unreasonableness on the adoptive parent's part, that the biological parent could go to the adoption court and try to, you know, get the court to say, you need to let them visit.
Okay. So you're not suggesting a change in this paragraph at this time, you're just pointing out.
Okay.
No. All right.
No, just sort of a continuation, something more that could be done.
Right.
I don't have comments on Section 2. I heard you that there were amendments to that allowing PFD eligibility for these kids out of state, both juvenile and China children. It would be a good thing. The only other comments I had were on Section 5, having to do with the expert witness testimony and allowing the court to make a determination as a matter of law. I think there's going to be real problems with this. There are equal requirements, Indian Child Welfare Act requirements that...
Just, Mr. Chairman, I think that's Section 6 now.
Oh, I'm sorry, Section 6 now.
Version you don't have is not in front of you, Linda, but I think you're talking about the section that begins section 4710-145, expert witness testimony, et cetera.
Okay. Through the chair, yes, Senator French, it's okay. That new section that wants to be added. The reason that the ICWA law, 25 U.S.C.S. 1912 subsection F, requires that before you can terminate parental rights, the state must put on evidence. And you cannot terminate parental rights unless the court can unless the state can prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and it has to include testimony of a qualified expert witness, that the continued custody of the child by the parent or Indian custodian is likely to result in serious emotional or physical damage to the child. So that's federal law. Allowing an offer of proof type situation without having the expert, and an expert witness is not that difficult. Many times it's a social worker that's the qualified expert witness. But to completely eliminate the requirement of an expert witness based upon some sort of judicial finding, and it's so, if you read through that paragraph, it's if this, if that, if this, I think it would be challenged, and I think it would be, you know, legitimately challenged and probably not withstand the challenge to completely eliminate the requirement of an expert witness in these situations. If, you know, when we're dealing with ICWA cases, I think we need to be careful. So I have some concerns about that section. And that's the extent of my comments. Thank you very much. I'll answer any questions if I can.
I guess I look at that paragraph and there's two ifs, in my opinion. Are there more?
Mr. Chairman,
sure.
If the court finds by clear and convincing evidence, then they have to find that the parent or guardian or custodian could not be located and after a reasonable search. And then the court has to conclude that the testimony of the qualified expert witness would support a finding that custody of the child by the absent parent would be likely to result serious. I mean, there's a lot of conditions on all of those findings the court has to make to then reach some sort of judicial notice, which really it isn't, that this expert would have said this if they had ever gotten one that they never did. So it's
so what you're saying is, the way you read this paragraph is that the court could say, well, a qualified expert witness would have found this way, so therefore I rule this way.
That's exactly what I think the paragraph is trying to do. And I don't think that's appropriate. I think they need to get the expert witness. And let that expert witness say, this is what I find.
Senator French?
Linda, maybe I haven't done these cases, so maybe I'm just taking too simplistic a view of this, but it just strikes me that this pertains to a very narrow finding in a fairly narrow set of circumstances. If and only if this parent has fled the jurisdiction, is can't be contacted by any reasonable means, has absented him or herself from the whereabouts of the child and the system and the attorneys and everything else, it just seems to me that there's no other conclusion you can strike that to put that child in the custody of that parent who's fled the jurisdiction would be bad news for the child. I don't see how you could reach any other conclusion if you can't find that person, if he or she is, I mean, it's not as if he or she's in jail, because you can find them when they're in jail. It's not as if he or she is left a forwarding address, because you can always find them in those circumstances and get them on the telephone. I mean, this person is willfully absenting him or herself from the life of the child and the raising of the child. So I guess I have a hard time understanding how you could reach any other conclusion if you bring an expert into the court and say, this parent is completely absent. Now, what would it be? What would it do to the emotional health of the child to put this child with a totally vacated parent?
I mean, it seems that way to me when I look at this. It says, we tried to find a parent, couldn't find a parent. Our two alternatives are leave him on the street or get him into custody. And it doesn't take much of an expert to determine that leaving a child on the street by themselves could result in serious emotional or physical damage. Senator Theriault?
Mr. Chairman, but I think the question is on lines 20 and 21, that the court, that the testimony we have qualified witness would support. So do you actually have to bring the witness in? Now, if you think that that's a nonsensical step, that there's no other conclusion, then why not just have the wording say that the court may conclude that the continued custody of the child is not in the child's best interest? I mean, why have the stuff in there about the expert witness? If you didn't bring them in,
is there
it clear that it, right. The court makes a finding based on the expert witness?
Is there a tension here? Is there a tension here between state and federal law? Is that what
That's
I heard?
My guess is that the federal law requires an expert witness to tell you that.
So we're just saying that, you know, we're accomplishing the step by allowing the court to insert its judgment as a qualified expert witness.
Well,
that's right.
But the witness actually has to come in to court.
No,
not now. Not if we pass this law. If we pass this law, the judge will say, you know what I think. This parent is completely gone. None of the lawyers in this room can tell me where this parent is. He's absent. She's absent. If I brought an expert in here and said, expert, should I put the child with this absent parent or should I put the child somewhere else? The expert would tell me putting the child with the absent parent would be bad news.
So we've got the extra verbiage just to satisfy the federal law.
Is that what it is?
Through the chair, yes.
Now, because so the judge doesn't have to go through the process of having someone come in and qualify that person on the record as an expert.
You save the system a couple hundred dollars, I imagine, every time you do this.
Through the chair, that's correct.
And in the Department of Law's opinion, will this satisfy the tension between the state and federal law?
We believe it would. I think Ms. Wilson would disagree with that position, but we believe that the ICWA requires a finding by a qualified expert and the offer of proof, which is basically what this would be, is you would make an offer of proof that if an expert qualified witness, expert witness, was to testify, they would make these findings that would meet the requirements of the Indian Child Welfare Act.
Ms. Wilson, what's in the best interest of the child here?
Well, I think it's in the best interest of the child to have the proceeding run the way it's supposed to run, and I think, you know, federal law requires an expert witness. Eliminating that just because it would be less expensive, I think it could be reversed and overturned, and then that's not in the best interest of the child. So I think it's better to pay what extra expense it is in these rare cases and get that qualified expert in there who is not that difficult to get. You know, Senator French gave the example of the worst-case scenario, but, you know, there's nothing in here that says a time frame of how long the parent was not locatable. You know, what is the reasonable search? I mean, he gave the worst-case scenario, but there may be some circumstances that are less, less severe than that. And I think by just getting around an element of what the state has to prove in these very serious cases of termination, that putting on that expert witness is not that onerous of an obligation, and it's an element, and I don't think you can eliminate it by making an offer of proof.
Can the opinion of a qualified expert witness be done by affidavit?
I would think you would need to have the testimony. Maybe Ms. Crayley would be able to. But it says testimony, so I don't think that an affidavit would qualify. Unless it was stipulated that you could proceed on the affidavit.
Stacy?
Through the chair. I hadn't really thought about that, so I'd have to think about it a little bit further, but I don't. I mean, there's other issues with respect to affidavits as evidence, with respect to cross-examination and other sorts of things. The premise under this section, just to kind of flesh it out a little bit further for the committee, is that, you know, we're not just talking about a very, you know, I mean, the statute requires that the department come in and submit to the court by clear and convincing evidence, which is a higher standard of proof, burden of proof, that after a reasonable search, so we're going to have to come in and say, you know, not 2 weeks, not, you know, I don't think the court I believe that there would be very few judges in this state who would say after 2 weeks of, you know, that would be considered a reasonable search for an unlocatable parent. I mean, we're talking about circumstances in adjudications or terminations where in many cases these parents have not been in the child's life before we took custody of these kids. Adjudication takes place within 120 days after a temporary custody hearing, so you're talking about 4 months, and termination has to take place within 15 to 22 months. So let's say, I mean, we're not talking about a very short period of time, and again, you've got the judicial oversight, and if the court believes that the department needs to take additional inquiry or further inquiry to find a parent, I think the court would say you haven't met your burden. You know, it's only been 2 weeks. It's only been a month since we've taken custody of these kids, and so you can't rely upon this offer of proof because you need to work a little bit harder to find a parent. And so I think that although there are a lot of conditions in there, I think the conditions safeguard the absent parent in the sense that the judge is going to have to make a judicial finding that we've made a reasonable search for a parent or a guardian or a custodian. And if we haven't met that initial burden, we wouldn't even get to the point where we'd be able to present an offer of proof.
Senator French?
How many different notices do you send to a parent to try to get them into the process, if you will? And where do you send to the, you know, PFD addresses? Do you send to last known addresses? Do you telephone work? I mean, tell me about some of the things you do to try to find a parent.
Through the chair, Senator French, when we're dealing with an absent parent currently in a case, whether it be an ICWA case, Indian Child Welfare case, or just a non-ICWA case, and we need to provide notice to the court of diligent inquiry for purposes of service of, say, a parent in a termination or any sort of type of proceeding, I know the paralegal in my office will make contact with the Department of Corrections, both in this state, and then get an NCIC criminal record check to see if the parent is incarcerated out of state. We will talk to Child Support Enforcement. We'll look at permanent fund dividends. We'll do a Motsnik search to see whether they have, you know, they're paying property tax or different sorts of issues statewide. And in addition, there's requirements under temporary custody orders and that sort of thing that if there is a parent that is known, that they cooperate with the department and provide us with information. And so, I mean, I know that in my office, when we have a belief that a parent is in, you know, another state, I mean, my paralegal will contact Children's Services in that jurisdiction, Corrections in that jurisdiction. You know, we do take it seriously because these are important issues and those sorts of things. So we would send out a number of different notices by certified mail, return receipt, and regular mail, and through the public defenders if we find out that they've been represented by an attorney in the past. So we do take the extra step.
Other questions? Other points, Linda?
No, that's the end of my testimony. Thank you very much.
Senator Guess, any questions?
No, thank you.
Okay. Do we have anyone else that wants to testify on any of the requirements or any parts of the bill? No one else online? Anyone in the audience? Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, in respect to Section 6, which we, multiple of us here, read that paragraph and essentially came to different conclusions about whether the witness was or not was not present. So at some point, as Senator Terrio said, maybe clarification that might be appropriate. Just as an observation, I was trying to go through scenarios in my mind that you could really have a conclusion made by an expert witness that would run contrary in any recurring cases that would make their presence necessary. And I didn't come up with any. Said another way, to have an expert witness in the courtroom for the comfort of a few of us to say we're protecting something in a so what proposition doesn't meet the so what test, to be redundant, in my estimation. So I expert witnesses don't exactly conjure up confidence for this particular scenario.
To me, this judge is probably looking, has the availability of a case file on the for his review or his or her review in the first place, doesn't he?
Yes.
And in that file, there will be notes, records, analysis of many people who would qualify, who could qualify as expert witnesses. I mean, it would seem to me that what the reason I was asking about affidavit or written testimony of that form, that while it may not meet the rules of formal evidence in a courtroom, and that's what I was asking, it would seem to me that it would provide a great deal of background to a judge to be able to decide as to whether or not a qualified witness would have resulted, would have determined that there could be serious emotional or physical damage to the child. I have spent a great deal of time listening to people from the legal community tell me that the judicial selection process only brings the cream of the crop to the bench. Are we questioning that? That these people, by looking at a file that would be, I would assume, would have a great deal of evidence in it that would just merely be reiterated by the qualified expert, is there for the judge to consider in the first place. Am I wrong there?
No.
I've never seen one of these files. So.
No. Mr. Chairman, I don't believe you are wrong in that. The files are very thorough. There's reports filed before most, if not all, hearings by the social workers, by the guardian ad litems, and all of those reports would have, if not an express statement to the effect that returning a child to an unlocatable or an absent parent would be contrary to their best interest and their welfare, put them at risk of safety and health and those sorts of things. There would be a lot of information and material within the file that the judge would have at his or her disposal to make such a finding.
So all we're eliminating is the physical presence of an expert in the courtroom at the time of this final hearing.
That's correct.
We've gone through the process. So I think that's the part that would concern me as a legislator. This isn't the first time someone has considered the question. Am I right?
And through the chair, the department engages in offers of proof a number of times in a number of different circumstances in China cases. What this does is it resolves a specific requirement under the Indian Child Welfare Act to have it creates the evidentiary basis for the expert testimony without having the expert actually in court.
And so in that regard, I think Ms. Wilson brings up a point that there may be a tension there, but I'm satisfied that the safety and best interest of the child is served by this process, because it appears to me that qualified expert witnesses have already come to that conclusion before it gets to this point. But, you know, I guess the only way we'll ever know whether there's a challenge to this tension there between federal and state law would be to see if one rises. Senator French?
Well, to be clear, it's not as if you're dispensing with expert witnesses in China cases or adoption cases or any child cases. It's just on this one narrow point. You know, I mean, there's still going to be plenty of expert witness testimony in these cases on different subjects. It's just not on this one point about absent parents.
No. That's why I feel comfortable with it in terms of our state procedure. The question of tension between state and federal law is one that I don't, Senator French. I mean, Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr.
Listening
Chair.
Listening to French pour the coffee there.
We have both have nice ties.
You both have, and we're wearing ties.
I have more hair. I have nicer hair. Where have I heard that?
I don't know. If I try not eat it.
No, the component I see here is the vaporizing parents. And I don't know all the circumstances where parents just disappear, vaporize, for lack of a better term, but clearly I would think that it would be a history that could be tracked, that you could predict that the parents in this case may vaporize or disappear or can't be contacted, because I just superimpose that upon my family and other than maybe a blue and white Super Cub that my wife and I crash in Cook Inlet, never to be heard again. I don't see many scenarios where that would happen, and you could track, well, maybe it was an airplane crash, but our history before that would hopefully show that we would be someplace it would be a catastrophic occurrence. Am I wrong in that when you look at the cases of parents where you can't contact them, that if you look back you can see some some evidence that we're leading to the conclusion of the parents didn't care about the child to start off with.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, sometimes that is true, but many times what we're looking at here are parents who could never be found from the very beginning. That these are parents who are absent from the time of the child's birth. Maybe mother was in
another.
We're
talking about little guys, babies. Okay, got it. Yeah, I did not think about that scenario. I stand corrected.
The chair sees no reason to continue the bill forward in this committee. What's the will of the committee? Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Judiciary CS for Senate Bill 83 from committee with individual recommendations. And I don't remember if there's fiscal notes.
Zero fiscal note.
With the attached zero fiscal note. Just one.
Is there objection? Hearing none. This bill has moved on to the next committee. Thank you, ladies, for your help. Move next to Senate Bill 84. We have the same cast of characters, but for the record, since this is on this bill, would you please put your names back on the record for us?
For the record, my name is Marcy Kanai. I'm the Department of Health and Social Services, and I oversee the Office of Children's Services. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for this opportunity to talk to you today about Senate Bill 84. Senate Bill 84 proposes new child protection confidentiality legislation that will allow us to provide more information to the public about agency actions surrounding child abuse and neglect cases. The proposal continues to protect the child's privacy while providing for disclosure of some state agency information. The intent of the bill is to shed light and educate the public on a very complex system, the child protection system. We believe it makes OCS and our other child protection partners much more accountable to the public. We believe it will begin to unveil what some perceive as a secret system, and it will lead to increased public trust. It should be noted that the state, a municipality, or a state or municipal agency, agencies, officers, employees, are immune from any action for damages based on any information that might be disclosed. I believe you all have a sectional analysis of the bill, so I'll just highlight four of the major areas that we propose to change. First, Senate Bill 84 opens child in need of aid hearings to the public, except in certain circumstances. Presently, all child in need of aid hearings are closed to the public. So this bill proposes that the hearings be open, except at the discretion, except if the judge believes that it would be harmful to the child or other parties, then the judge could close those hearings. It also, moving further into the bill, also allows the department to release the name and picture of a child in a China proceeding for the purposes of achieving permanency after all parental rights have been terminated. And this helps us to expedite permanency for a child, for those children for whom we are already the parent. That is, the parental rights have been terminated, so the department is, in effect, the child's parent. There are adoption exchanges. You may have seen Wednesday's Child over the last few months. Right now, we have to go to court, get a court order in order to put the child's picture on a national exchange or a local exchange. So this would enable us to do this if we are already the parent of the child. Senate Bill 84 also expands the circumstances under which the department is required to share confidential information in China proceedings. It adds caregivers or entities responsible for the safety of a child and review panels established for the purpose of reviewing action taken by the department in a given case to that list of individuals and agencies entitled to receive information. Senate Bill 84 also allows the department to share confidential information in China proceedings with the public under three specific circumstances. First, if a parent has already made a public disclosure, in effect, they have waived their right to confidentiality, so we could then respond to their allegations. If an alleged perpetrator has been criminally charged with a crime relating to abuse or neglect, many times the charging documents are public anyway, and so this would enable us to talk about whether or not we have done an investigation, what the agency's actions have actually been in those cases. And the third circumstance is if a report of harm has resulted in a fatality or a near fatality. We believe we should be responsive to the public, and we'd like to be able to tell the public what we have or have not done in those cases. Essentially, states have been kind of debating the pros and cons of relaxing their confidentiality statutes for years. Some of the pros of opening confidentiality and enabling people to attend China hearings, as well as to enable the department to talk a little more about the cases that we're involved in. First of all, it can increase public awareness and education of just child abuse and neglect in general, and that can lead to breaking the cycle of abuse. Public awareness of court hearings may mean that more witnesses will come forward, and that could lead to better evidence in cases. An increase in public scrutiny also leads to enhanced judicial performance and more accountability for the courts and all of the attorneys involved. It's also an increased accountability for our staff in that we need to be certainly better prepared or more prepared or adequately prepared as we go into court. And it basically, we believe it will increase the public trust in the child protection system. I'd be happy to answer any other questions that you might have about language.
Questions from the members. Senator Terrio.
You said that one of the things that triggers this is if the parents have made a public statement and basically waived their rights, would you feel like you can make comments only to respond, or from that point forward, it's been put out in the public and it's okay now to discuss that case?
I believe that the law leaves that to the department's discretion, but I think when a parent comes forward and talks about agency actions or inactions, that's what we would like to be able to respond. I personally do not believe that we ever want to get into details about a family's life. But I think lots of times people do go to the press, they say the department has investigated 7 times and didn't do anything, or the department never investigated, we made calls, the department never investigated. At this point, we can't say a word. We would like to be able to come forth and talk about what our actions have or have not been. We believe the public deserves that that kind of oversight.
It's sort of a rebuttal in the court of public opinion.
Pretty much. Without jeopardizing the family's history.
Which section of the bill describes that?
And the version we are looking at is 1082/G for the record.
Section 3.
I'm sorry, where are we?
We're on, starting in Section 3, which starts on page 3.
I think it's 13, maybe?
Through the chair, that I think you're correct, Senator French.
It's 13.
Yes. Page 7, starting on line 17.
Page 7, line 17.
So the type of information you may disclose is in subsection L, and that is information related to the determination, if any, made by the department regarding the validity of a report of harm, So that would be things like we investigated and we found the child had a bloody, you know, forehead, or we investigated and found the child had no marks on it at all. Right? I mean, you would be sort of not vouching for it, but you'd be substantiating or not substantiating a report upon it. Is that right?
Through the chair, that's correct.
And the department's activities arising from the department's investigation of the report, and that's your response to their claim that they never came out of the, or they've been harassing me. In either case, you can say no. Yeah, you say we never came out. We came out 7 times. Here are the dates of our visits. Or, you know, in response to the citizen's complaint that you're harassing me, you'll say no. We came, you know, at 10 o'clock in the morning. You know, 3 days in a row. It's not as if we've been there at midnight or on weekends or harassing you at work. And so you try to rebut those claims.
Is there, Marcy, anywhere in this require? Is there? I'm not saying that there would be any overreactive people in the department that may make public comment and rebuttal that may not be in an official position of the department. And I noticed that you also have a requirement in there. You say that you may withhold disclosure information that could jeopardize a criminal proceeding. Is there any requirement that before you release any information that you consult with the district attorney to make sure that you're not releasing information that would interfere with a criminal proceeding?
through the chair, Mr. Chairman, I think on page 8, line 4, I don't know if it would be characterized as a requirement, but it does require that after consultation with the prosecuting attorney, the department may withhold or disclosure of information that may interfere with the crime. So I think it contemplates at least a.
But you already can do that. You can withhold any information you want to. Already, can't you?
Mr. Chairman, actually, we have to withhold any information. So if there's a criminal charge that is filed and there's a corresponding or an allegation that it involves a child or it would have been a case that would arise under the child need of aid statutes, and a crime is charged and it's on the front page of the paper and they call the Office of Children's Services and say, well, what have you done? We can't even comment about whether or not we even know anything about the family.
So isn't this really a restatement of a truism that already exists?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think what this does is, in a way, yes, but what it does allow us to do is to say when a crime has been committed and a parent has been charged, that if there is an allegation of child abuse and a reporter calls us to ask us, what have you done, we can actually answer the question, whereas if this bill doesn't pass, we can't even answer the question of whether or not we've done anything good or bad. And so what it does
I agree with that. Right. I see what you're trying to get to. I'm just... is this paragraph in here for cover, or is it in here for a particular purpose? I'm not trying to be nitpicky.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's in there for cover. I think it's just in there to make sure that there's a coordinated effort between the Office of Children's Services and the District Attorney's Office to make sure that as they proceed in their criminal investigations and we have our concurrent processes, that nobody's stepping on anybody's toes and creating problems in either of the cases.
And I guess that's what I'm getting to in that regard. Go ahead, Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Originally, we had a conversation before we turned to page number 7 that talked about, you know, essentially allowing you to talk to the press or being able to make a statement to refute something that was going on in the court of public opinion, as stated by the chair. But as I read the provision, it's only upon request. Is that right? I mean, you can't go on a prosecutor's or defender's sort of rampage, for lack of a better term, in the local newspaper to state the department's case because you're tarnishing our image, sort of thing. As I see it, it says upon request. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, yes, I believe.
Now, I'm not naive enough to think that, you know, you couldn't communicate with a reporter or say, ask me the question. I guess I'm a little nervous in the respect of falling into the syndrome of where the state government's taking on an individual and we're kind of prosecuting in the court of public opinion. But in other respect, I mean, I think we also understand if the press is asking a question or whomever it is that you can respond to. But you can't be prosecuting by your own initiative only upon request. Is there any exceptions to that?
Through the chair, I don't believe so, Senator Huggins.
So this could be upon request from just an interested individual, or someone who's just curious.
Like a neighbor?
A neighbor.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, yes. I mean, I think that the
legitimate and personal with legitimate interest.
Under the section, next page, page 8, line 11 through 13, the statute requires the department to adopt regulations to interpret the duties under the section, which would require, you know, we're not envisioning
a significant legitimate interest.
There would be a limitation on, you know, who could ask for the information and who we could reply to. So that would narrow the scope or further define it.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And who do you envision that being? I mean, if you're going to define that, I mean, who do you envision those the
person
parameters?
With legitimate persons with legitimate interest. Well, certainly the parent, either parent, has a legitimate interest. I believe sometimes the press has a legitimate interest, and I believe we will define that in regulation when that would be true.
Sometimes the parents, I mean, I think, or the press, I mean, I think it's for you to make a judgment call of when it's good for them and when it's bad for them makes me a little bit nervous, if you follow my logic. So I'm not nitpicking you. The press, let's just say the press. I understand. Other...
Of course, there are some people I tend to call the legitimate press, and some the
illegitimate press. Well, I mean, you obviously, I mean, I'm not asking you to come to conclusion of who those are, but I think it's one that does need to be well defined for all the reasons we're talking about.
I think it's the intent of the department here to just run around and tell anybody that wants to know. Or you get a crusader that's just trying to stir the pot. That's not a legitimate request, but I suppose I can see the reason why you would like to be able to defend yourself sometimes in the public arena, as long as it didn't conflict with the best interest of the child. And to be able to comment sometimes, even if it's in a deferring manner, where now you really can't comment on it at all, can you?
Not at all, through the chair, not at all.
Senator French.
My question is kind of the other half of Senator Huggins' question. He's concerned about who can make the request. My concern is who in the department will have authority to make the decision.
Okay, through the chair, Senator French, we have one spokesman for the department. The commissioner would decide who would be making the statements to the press.
But I guess my question is, who will decide whether to release information to the press? Is it the commissioner that will ultimately decide in each case, you know, we need to respond to this, or we need to be, you know, we'll just ignore it? Who in the department will have the authority to release this confidential information?
It would be the commissioner or the commissioner's designee.
Is that written down in here, or is that?
That was one of my earlier questions that I had written myself a note to follow up on too, Senator French, in that on line 18, who was my question. Who in the department may disclose?
I mean, I've got
don't want the individual caseworker just running out there.
Or even a staff lawyer or someone else. I mean, I the further up the chain, I guess the more confidence I'll have that there's some accountability and deliberation before this happens.
There comes a step in the hierarchy where I feel a great deal more confidence, whether that's the commissioner or someone designated by the commissioner. And in many cases, it could be the commissioner or the commissioner's designee. And the commissioner could designate that to a regional official, you know, all kinds of different ways. It gives the commissioner the right to designate.
It
takes an affirmative action to have a designee. This can't be anyone.
Through the chair, I understand. We're both thinking that there is a provision in here, but flipping through this quickly is not going very well.
You wouldn't be opposed to a sentence that said that, and maybe even in this section, just so we could. I think you know, we're breaking new ground here, and so I think folks want to make sure we go slowly. We don't jump from total secrecy to total openness, that we kind of gradually move into a happy medium.
Through the chair, Senator French, I could have sworn that was in here, actually, that it actually says the commissioner or the commissioner's designee. We can't find it, but I don't know if you can find it.
Let's take a 5-minute recess, and then we'll look at that, and we'll be back in 5 minutes.
We're back on the record. We did not find the elusive indicator of who is qualified to do that, but you said you have an idea, ladies.
We have an idea. Through the chair, first of all, just to clarify, the department does have clear policy on media and who speaks to the media, and so I just want to put that on the record. But for the purposes of this bill, I think in under Section 13, subsection K, was that what you were thinking, Stacy? We would add, instead of the department in line 18, it would be the commissioner or the commissioner's designee.
So, we'll propose an amendment to delete in line 18 the word department and replace it with commissioner or commissioner's designee. Proposed amendment number one. Chair will propose it. Is there objection? Hearing none, amendment number one is adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Guess.
I had a question on Section 13.
Go ahead.
Can you speak to why on L1 and L2 those are mays and not shalls? Are there certain situations where we would want this information disclosed? It just seems as if there are clear enough situations that we should be. Both on page 7, line 3, page 8, line 4.
Right.
Sorry, page 7, line.
It's line 131.
The may withhold, and then on both number one and on number two under section L, both of those are mays, and it seems like the situation was such that I was wondering why you decided to use a may and decide to use a shall on ensuring that the information was withheld in these situations.
I kind of had that same question. If you followed, I had made myself a note to follow up on that as well, Senator Guest, but I didn't look at line 31. I just was considering line 4 on page 8. But Ladies?
Through the chair, I appreciate the question, but I think the reason for doing that is that, you know, in different circumstances, requests would come in that may or may not disclose identifiable information. And in that instance, if you had a shall, as an example, a reporter calls and asks a question about a specific family, or there's a disclosure in the paper about a specific family and names and those sorts of personally identifiable information are disclosed, and to respond without having the ability to either put that information, you know, back into the public discourse would be a little disingenuous. So I think there's instances where that information isn't disclosed, where we would want the ability to keep that identifiable information out. But in those instances where it is disclosed, we would want to be able to confirm. And you couldn't answer a question about a specific child if you weren't allowed to maybe mention that specific child's name. So I think it's more of a case-by-case analysis for the different circumstances that we're faced with. You know, if there's a general question about a case without any sort of identifiable information, then we wouldn't want to have to disclose that information. We would want to be able to keep that privileged.
Senator French.
Thank you. I share Senator Guess's and the chairman's concern, and I guess I'm just thinking that if under the totality of the circumstances you decided that it's in the best interests of the child to sort of go public, you know, because the press has gone public or the neighborhood's gone public or the school, you know, for some reason this has now been thrust to the headlines, then you decided, okay, the best thing we can do for this child is to respond to the allegation in the press. Then the second part of the sentence would allow you to do that. That is, I'm not being as clear as I should be, but if the sentence read shall withhold disclosure, if the department determines that the disclosure would be contrary to the best interest of the child, you could still disclose if you decided, you know, all things considered, it's time, we've got to respond to the child. That is, you know, it may be that the child is being harmed by these reports in the press that say, for example, that he or she's being tortured, or he or she's being, you know, abused by her teacher, or something. And the best thing you can do is say, no, that's false. We've looked into this, and let's get this kid out from underneath this cloud. And but if you determine that it's against the best interest of the child to go public, it seems like you've got to keep the child's name secret.
And so, what my concern is, if you would discretionarily withhold it, wouldn't it be better for you to have the cover of the law to say you shall not disclose it?
Mr. Chairman, that makes sense.
Yes.
It does.
Okay. So, why don't, Senator Guess, are you proposing an amendment here?
If the committee agrees, I would reiterate, because of that second part of the best interest, I think the identification is, and I would propose changing page 7, line 31, the may to a shall. I'll hold up proposing the second shall until there's more conversation with the committee.
At this point, amendment number 2 has been proposed by Senator Guest to replace the word may on line 31, page 7, with a shall. Is there objection? Hearing none, amendment number 2 is adopted. Discussion on line 4, page 8. Here again, I have pretty much the same thought in that if the department can talks with a member of a prosecuting attorney, and they're getting pressured by press to reveal information that they don't want to, then it would appear to me that the law saying shall not, we talked with our district attorney, and this we cannot reveal any information which may jeopardize the criminal proceeding, would give the department better cover than the word may.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with that.
Chair would propose that we change line 4, page 8, from the word may to the word shall. Is there objection? Amendment, Senator Terrio.
Some questions on section 14. I'm just trying to think, how is this all balanced with what the public needs to know to protect itself? And just trying to think ahead here. I understand you don't want to jeopardize the case or criminal investigation. I'll withdraw my objection for the time being.
Any further objection to the amendment? Amendment number 3 is adopted. Further discussion? Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, on section 14, since the CARPA now has the right to release information, and I understand why you would want to indemnify for the disclosure of information. If somebody makes an allegation, well, that harmed me now. But you've also got wording in there, or the non-disclosure. So you have the right to release certain information that perhaps the public needs to protect itself. But if you choose not to, there's no consequences. And a particular case here in Juneau, there was a young man in high school still who had a record. It's my understanding that the school didn't know about his record, and he raped a 14-year-old girl in one of the bathrooms at school. The school says, we had no idea about this kid. So I'm just wondering if you've got the right to release this information in that type of case, if you chose not to, you have no good reason why you chose not to, why the state should just have immunity.
I wonder, are we dealing in this chapter with information that's requested by individuals?
Mr. Chairman, as I read the, with respect to referencing back to section 13, yes, because that's all upon the request of a party for the information.
So I have no problem indemnifying the disclosure or non-disclosure of requested information from people with a substantial interest in the particular case. But I don't know if that same scenario would rise, Senator Terrio, under this information where they're requesting information. Senator French?
Well, I've got some puzzlement about this as well, and I guess maybe the first thing the department can help me do is sort of help me segment juvenile delinquency information from child need of aid information. Where do they intersect, and where are they separate? Because I think what Senator Terrio brought up may have been something that came to light in a delinquency proceeding or a criminal proceeding, and the types of information we're talking about here is China information. I've got constituents who are extremely up in arms over the difficulty they're having with the juvenile justice system, but I'm not sure. I think it arose in a delinquency proceeding or a criminal proceeding and not in a China proceeding. So maybe you can first of all tell us when those types of information are the same and when they're separate.
Through the chair, Senator French, I think that's a very important distinction, and these provisions here would deal with the disclosure or non-disclosure in child in need of aid proceedings under Title 4710. The juvenile justice process is a separate process and governed by separate statutes and different separate requirements. They used to be all together within the department, and then they've been separated out. And so that's part of the if you will, disconnect with the current statutory scheme is that the when things got separated out, they didn't all get separated out quickly and clearly. So, but this bill would specifically address child in need of aid proceedings. There are instances when child in need of aid proceedings and juvenile justice proceedings do overlap, where you have a child who has a delinquency charge who may also be in custody. Now, if we had custody of a child in the Office of Children's Services, then these rules and disclosures and requirements would apply for our purpose. We wouldn't have any information we'd have information, but we would be able to disclose information with respect to the juvenile justice process. And this bill doesn't envision addressing those issues. There may be similar policy arguments for the disclosure in that circumstance, but this bill doesn't contemplate that.
But when a parent harms a child, you've got maybe a criminal action against the parent, and suddenly you've got a child in need of aid case because you've got a hurt infant or we'll just say child. But by the same token, if a 16-year-old rapes a 14-year-old, you've got a criminal charge against a 16-year-old. Do you suddenly have a child in need of aid case against involving the 14-year-old?
Through the chair, no, we do not.
Or probably not.
Probably not. That's true. There may
what, be. What if it happens in the same household?
It would, again, through the chair, it would depend upon the factual situation and what the allegation was and what the parent's role or not their lack
non-role,
of role would be.
Right.
And it may be that there would be some circumstances where, with your second scenario, where a 14-year-old raped somebody or a member of the household, and that still may not give rise to a child in need of aid proceeding, depending upon what the parents did, knew, didn't do, how they responded, what the circumstances were. It may just simply be a juvenile justice proceeding, and we wouldn't be involved at all. I mean, we would investigate if there was a report of harm, but we may not take custody because there wouldn't be grounds to take custody.
Senator Terrio, could we address your concern by on line 17? After the word information, inserting the word requested.
Based on the disclosure or non-disclosure of information requested.
We're giving the department discretion to disclose information. We need to provide them cover for when someone says, you didn't give me everything I wanted to have. I would think.
Well, the apocalyptic worst-case scenario always pops into mind, and that's, a blabbermouth commissioner who, upon a case that happens in some part of the state, there's a report of harm, there's some press, and suddenly the commissioner's in front of the television saying, spilling his or her guts about everything the department knows on the case with absolutely no regard to what's right, what's appropriate, or what's necessary. And I guess in those circumstances, we just indemnified that person, total immunity in the face of gross negligence, and I guess I'm a little bit concerned about that. If policies have been followed and we're being careful about structuring the law so that there's some oversight and some policies, that's fine. No one wants to see a stupid lawsuit over, him giving out an address when the press already gave the address out. On the other hand, if we're divulging very sensitive details about a child's life and making this child now, maybe a poster child when that child didn't want to be for some cause, that's wrong. And I think most people would agree that's wrong. So I'm kind of struggling with how you sort of preserve the need for the department to be free to do what it needs to do with the need for a child to have some right to privacy. And for that child to be able to vindicate its rights if someone makes a grievous error.
A response?
Through the chair, I appreciate the comment and the sentiment behind the gross negligence kind of scenario. I think the Department of Law and the Department of Health and Social Services would like the ability to discuss this information as the statute contemplates without fear of, frivolous lawsuits, and to the extent that the committee thinks that that grant of authority needs to be maybe limited so that gross negligence and those sorts of things are excluded from that immunity. Those are, we want to be able to talk to people without fear of liability and lawsuits, and so any immunity would be appreciated, and we understand the policy arguments that are being made here.
Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I can understand, and I know, what was it, 6-7 years ago that the separation took place? This area of law is undergoing tremendous changes. It used to be both those things together, China, juvenile justice, no information at all. It was cut and dry. So we've come a long way, and now there might be some complication here because of the separation, and perhaps, you know, my case perhaps is more juvenile justice, but what about when you have somebody that maybe is in a foster setting and commits a crime afterwards, so they're still in the foster setting in custody of the state, or you know, how does information get out then when you've got that overlap of the two systems? Who's responsible?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, if I'm understanding you correctly, if you'll turn to page 6. Actually, it's section 9, which begins on page 5. The bill talks about that we can disclose appropriate confidential information to certain parties. And number 3 on page 6, line 5, talks about school officials. That if we have information about a child in custody that could be harmful to other children in that school, we do disclose that to the school official.
But what if you don't? If you do not disclose and there's resulting harm under section 14, you have blanket immunity.
If I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, an employee of the division would be, as long as they were performing within the scope of their employment, would be covered under respondeat superior. Am I correct for their liability?
Mr. Chairman, the general immunity provisions under Title IX would provide some level of protection. And an employee acting within the scope of their employment, a social worker who made a disclosure, and I want to add something to Ms. Kanai's comments to Senator Terrio, but they would be defended, you know, the state would defend their actions,
right,
if they're acting within their employment. But I wanted to comment to Senator Terrio, if I may, that currently Title 47, 10093 provides a list of circumstances where the department and its employees can disclose information to guardian ad litems, to other agencies working with the children, governmental agencies, police, et cetera, et cetera. Your point is well taken, that the immunity provision that's contemplated in this statute allows, there's no requirement I wouldn't say there's not a requirement that we don't disclose, because the idea is that we have the ability, when we have this information, to get information out to people who need this information to properly protect children that are in our custody, other kids who aren't in our custody, and that sort of thing. So I think the information is disseminated, but your comment being that if we didn't disclose the immunity provision as contemplated, you know, covers us and gives us kind of the ability to, or doesn't charge us with any liability if we fail to disclose information that we otherwise should have under the statute. I think that goes back to what Senator French was talking about in terms of whether or not that non-disclosure was, you know, as a matter of law, inappropriate, or, you know, if it was negligent or, you know, gross negligence not to disclose that. It's a lot of information that we have, and sifting through it and answering questions from a lot of different people, you know, there may be circumstances where something doesn't get disclosed when it was just purely you know, happenstance and it wasn't an intentional non-disclosure, or we don't have all of the information and something happens, you know, at our disposal. So, and I think that on a day-to-day basis, we do a very good job of communicating with all other agencies and entities that deal with the kids that are in our custody. And of course, there may be those instances where something doesn't get said or done that is unfortunate, but I don't think that it's an intentional act on our part. It's just more, you know, depressive day-to-day business and not, you know, a lot of kids and a lot of cases and a lot of work. So, but the bill does contemplate a blanket immunity for the disclosure or non-disclosure of information. And it may be also, as I look at the bill, that the non-disclosure component of that immunity section under 14 may be directly related back up to section 13, where we just amended the may's to shall. And the may would have been a non-disclosure. We would have had the ability to non-disclose, and that immunity, that provision may relate back up to those shalls, if that makes sense.
I think that makes sense.
And now that we've changed it to a shall, under subsection K, there's not an ability not to disclose. We're going to withhold this information, so there wouldn't be a non-disclosure issue.
Other questions? Let's move, Senator Taylor.
Well, I guess I would request maybe just a little more time to think about whether there's some language that would make sense that, you know, makes it clear that if there's negligence, number one, in information that was disclosed, or information that should have been disclosed that wasn't, I mean, it's going to be a small consolation to a parent whose child is injured due to the lack of information, perhaps. That, well, geez, we're busy that week, and something slipped. Yeah.
Yep. Let's move on to, we have two people that want to testify on this bill this morning as well. Let's move to Scott Calder in Fairbanks first. Scott, are you still with us?
Good morning, Senator Seekins. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you. If you put yourself on the record, sir, we're eager to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Calder, C-A-L-D-E-R, and good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I've been really trying to see the good in this bill, and there's a few things that I'm concerned they haven't been entered into the discussion yet that I think are of great importance. First of all, I think we have the reality of two different classes of victims. We have the victims of individuals in society that the department would like to help in some way. And then we have, unfortunately, and probably unintentionally, the victims that are created by the department itself for whatever reason, under whatever circumstances. The problem that the people in that last category, such as myself, people who've been victimized by the department, continually identify is the facts and circumstances in a particular instance can indicate that there has been some negligence or error on the part of the department. And sometimes that is because parents have not gotten information that they needed or have been dealt with dishonestly by the department. So rather than assuming that that's what the department will do all the time, even though that is kind of a standard tactic in an adversarial process, it just seems to me that the appropriate thing to do here would be to have an explicit statement or declaration or protection for people who are acting in good faith, who are minding their own business, and have done nothing else wrong except they just happen to be one of those dreaded parents or people in society who have what has been referred to as a legitimate interest. And I think if we defined ahead of time that there are a lot of, you know, good people who have legitimate interest, and then have the burden on the department to decide, you know, who is not in that category, that would be a better philosophical approach. It seems to me that it would be good to have some kind of language in here to talk about what the person's need-to-know basis is. It seems to me that a parent, absent any type of criminal charges or other, you know, actual evidence or judicial process, has the highest need-to-know basis regarding information about their own child, and that we should not assume that because when the department comes for its money, it says, oh, you know, we would never do that. So we should just have some kind of legal protection for those of us out here in the world that, you know, occasionally see things that the department won't tell you about. Now, I like Amendment Number 1, which you adopted, dealing with the commissioner or designee. I think that really puts a cap on it and keeps it at a responsible level. I like the shalls instead of the mays. I think that makes sense. And let's see what else here. Okay. The concern about whether the image of the department is tarnished, I think the discussion about that is a little troubling, because in some instances, and I don't want to say in every instance or, you know, by virtue of the existence of the department, but in some instances, I think the department's image has been tarnished for very good reasons. I know that before I had those reasons, I just always assumed that everything was okay. But, you know, you get to a point where, you know, that what the department's doing, or maybe a piece of legislation or something, just doesn't pass the smell test or a reality check. And, you know, ordinary people out here in the world can't just go hire a bunch of lawyers and a staff to run their affairs for them, or to deal with a legal adversary that they may not even know about because they're denied information about their own child. So I would like to see this, if, you know, not just work on one side of the problem. Now, one of the things that I realized in thinking about this is that the department might feel unable to issue a public apology to my family unless the confidentiality laws are relaxed somewhat. So, I can see why it would be a good thing to do the idea of what is in Senate Bill 84, but there is a critically important missing idea, and that is that parents should never be in the position where the department has the discretion to not disclose to them information about their own child. And historically, that has been a very destructive problem in the state of Alaska. And maybe I could just kind of pause there, and if there's any questions or...
Mr. Carlin, this is Senator Seekins.
Yes, sir.
What about in the case where, as we contemplate it on page 8, where information would about a child, even disclosed to a parent, could reasonably be expected to interfere with a criminal investigation? Are you saying that that information should be just spontaneously given to the parent, even if there's pending criminal action against the parent?
Well, I don't see how that could be a good idea. Now, I don't know what this hypothetical that we're considering here, you know, what type of a criminal investigation or you know, whatever that would be. But it seems to me that the best interest, that, let me try to put this in a succinct idea here, the interest of a parent to guard the best interest of his or her child, I think, is more important and more significant for the well-being of our society than the interest of the department to safeguard the best interests of the child. Most people in the world are not creating the problems that we're talking about here. Most people are minding their own business and taking care of their kids and doing the right thing, and they don't, you know, not really, I feel, should not be a subject of discussion in this context. And so what I'm concerned about is how do we protect, you know, the rights of the normal people who aren't bothering anybody. Now, it doesn't make sense to me that you would want to interfere with a criminal investigation or a proceeding by releasing information, but I'm not sure how that would actually threaten a person's ability to guard the best interests of their child. I suppose that if it were a matter of me being able to protect the best interests of my child or the state being able to protect the best interests of a criminal investigation, then it would be better to protect the child first. Probably the department would agree with that philosophy. So
the charges may be brought against the parent.
Well, then I guess you have to have to prove something about that parent. Maybe you should do the criminal charges first instead of...
Absolutely.
You know, we're talking about hypotheticals, right. Senator Seekin, so it's a little difficult without an actual fact set to refer to. But I think that the main point is here that if the department determines that the information would reasonably be expected to interfere, then they either may withhold the disclosure or shall withhold the disclosure. I mean, I think it's still up to them to control that activity. But what we're trying to say here is, you know, that they should release the information or they should withhold the information in the types of situations that we can predict, not every specific instance or every specific hypothetical.
Well, I appreciate your viewpoint, and I'll tell you, when as a parent of four and a grandparent of six, there were times when I wish the state would have come and take a couple of my kids away, and I'm sure that there were times when they thought that the state should have came and take me away. And in either case, it might have, may or may not have been justified, but...
careful what we wish for, I guess. Yeah,
but there were, you know, I think our primary interest here is to act in the best interest of the child, and I do believe that in most cases... that parents are doing that.
So we should protect, forgive me, Mr. Chairman, but so we should protect the innocent people who aren't bothering anybody first, and then, you know, in a safer world, you know, perhaps then we could go after the bad people. Mr. Chairman, there's something that I forgot to mention. May I do so briefly?
If you do so quickly, yes.
Okay. We have language in here regarding court rules and also some statutory language that indicates that the initial court hearing after the filing of a petition and a hearing following the initial hearing in which a parent, child, or other party to the case is present but has not had an opportunity to obtain legal representation. This is in, looks like, Section 3 on page 3, lines 10 through 14, it looks like, and then there's a court rule change. I think that we should have those hearings especially be open. And remember, Mr. Chairman, and I don't think there's been discussion to the contrary, the court could decide to close the proceeding or the department could decide not to disclose information. I don't think we would want to, ahead of time here, say that these hearings are off limits. Oftentimes, these are the hearings where it's very clear that the department is pursuing the wrong direction or that there may be some other help that's needed. This is the first time that the parties show up at a court, Mr. Chairman, and I think that that is exactly when we need to have the possibility that the public will be included unless there is a specific stated reason to exclude them. So I would encourage a change in that regard. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Ms. Wilson, I know you're still with us, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Let's get started with what your observations are.
Thank you. Again, this is Linda Wilson, Deputy Director of Public Defender Agency. I would like to talk about the first part of the bill that we really, except for Mr. Caller's comments, haven't really been discussed a whole lot. This is certainly a very significant change to our statutes if this bill becomes law. Opening up child and youth aid court hearings is a significant change of the way we have been doing things in the past. I believe that there are about 18 states that have open China hearings. 13, I think, are discretionary and 5 are automatic. So the vast majority of states continue to keep these proceedings closed. The concerns about opening up the hearings are there are many circumstances where the hearings are going to need to be closed because you are talking about sensitive information, confidential information about treatment that is going to necessitate motions to close these hearings. And so there is going to be a lot of litigation over going in and out of closed and open hearings because of the need to keep those hearings closed because of the sensitive information that's going to need to be discussed. So is going to require more work. There are also reasons, I think, to worry about opening it up. I think you may find that in these types of cases, we are talking about some of the deepest, darkest secrets in families. There's sensitive family information and history that's shared in these proceedings. I think we may find some hesitation on some children to be willing to talk or participate because of the open forum. I think we may find some parents less willing to address some of their issues, their substance abuse or their parenting deficiencies, given the public stigma. They may opt instead to litigate, profess their innocence, because they don't want to admit that they've done anything wrong. We may see them wanting to take on the system in the open forum as well. It's just too early to tell. I mean, I guess there's sort of a change is kind of a scary thing. And there will be, I think, it will be very different. The part of the bill that I also want to comment on was the part that you have so well discussed already, and listening into your comments, it's very nice to hear all of the good comments and discussion that the committee is having over these sections. The Section 13 talking about disclosing information. We talked about disclosing information when a parent has shared information, and what we haven't really talked about is a scenario where one parent discloses information, but what about the non-offending parent who, you know, in many of these circumstances, the parents aren't together. One parent shares information with the press, and now OCS gets to decide to share more information, and here's this other parent out there that didn't want any of this revealed. What about that? That's concerning. There's nothing in here about distinguishing between different parents when these public disclosures are being made. I think the discussion you had about the changes from May to shall are legitimate, and I think those have been good amendments because there are some concerns about disclosures that are made that the department could decide they want to disclose because they want to respond to what that parent said. And maybe what the parent disclosed is inappropriate and not in the best interest of the child. And OCS may want to respond to it, but their response may be equally not in the best interest of the child. And that's worrisome. So now we have this whole airing out to the public that doesn't do this child any good. So I think changing it to shall is a good thing. So I'm certainly willing to answer questions that any of the committee members have. I appreciate the hard work you're doing and at your service.
Questions for Ms. Wilson. Senator French.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure I'm going to have questions for Ms. Wilson. This is a big bill, and it's got a lot of parts to it. And I guess I just don't know how much time we have to go into
it. Well, I think we're about at the limit of our committee meeting. This next available time for this bill to be heard will be on Wednesday, March the 2nd. And that will give us time, if you have questions or additional concerns, to be able to address them with the presenters or with Ms. Wilson. And Ms. Wilson, if you have specific comments that you would like to address to the committee, if you have notes that you'd like to send them through my office, we'd be interested in hearing it, as well as anything, Mr. Calder, that you want to submit in terms of written information, we're more than willing to take a look at that. So with that in mind, we're going to carry this bill over, and we'll reschedule it on our calendar for Wednesday, March the 2nd. For anything else that needs to come to the attention of the committee today, with that,
Chairman,
yes.
Just briefly, if you're going to deal with some of these amendments that have come through, I think under Section 13, you're going to need to make some corrective amendments to subparagraph L when you change department to commissioner and its designee. So I would just make note of that for legislative legal to make sure that comports, because subparagraph L references
right
back to K, and there may need to be some corrective amendments there.
Okay. Staff will be leaving until early next week, but could you make sure that we get that over, maybe Mr. Hove, and then ask them if we can get an amended version?
I think the only change would have to be on line 30 where it says the department, and that's going to be I think that needs to read the commissioner or the commissioner's designee, which would track the language on
gotcha
line 18.
Good point.
And maybe if you can help communicate.
Help me communicate.
Just if you'd just drop us a little note to make sure. Then we'll ask the drafter to get us a clean version to take a look at in our next hearing on May 2nd from what we have done so far. With that, this meeting is adjourned.